gold, the Bitcoin hold.com. The Bitcoin self-custody is the whole. Find the strength inside your soul. Your soul. Oh, the Bitcoin hold.com.
You know, when you first get into Bitcoin, the ultimate goal always sounds like building this impenetrable digital fortress.
Right, the whole sovereign citadel idea.
Exactly. You generate your seed phrase, you stamp it into a piece of steel, lock it in a heavy physical safe, and you just think, okay, I've built the moat.
Yeah, the drawbridge is up.
Right, I am entirely self-sovereign now.
It is a very comforting thought. I mean, that idea of absolute localized control, just you against the world, secured entirely by math.
But then, you know, you look out from the top of your fortress.
Yeah.
And you realize something a bit unsettling. Like, who actually paved the roads leading up to this castle?
Oh, yeah.
Who coordinates the guards? Because, I mean, if the map to my fortress is stored on a server owned by a tech giant, and the people building my drawbridge coordinate their blueprints on a corporate platform that can just, you know, ban them overnight.
Which literally just happened. Yeah.
Right. Then how sovereign am I, really?
That tension right there is exactly what is erupting across the ecosystem right now. The illusion of complete isolation is kind of breaking down, and we're being forced to reckon with the actual infrastructure that surrounds our self-custody setups.
Well, welcome to this episode of The Deep Dive. Today, we are mapping out this rapidly shifting spectrum of control. We've been looking at a massive stack of the latest change logs, developer updates, and infrastructure reports from this past week.
It's been a busy week.
It really has. And our mission today is to extract the underlying mechanisms of what is actually changing so you can stay sharp on your own self-custody practices. We're talking about major firmware updates turning hardware wallets into, like, programmable security engines.
Yeah, totally redefining what a signing device is.
Exactly. We're also looking at a massive philosophical divide in how mobile wallets operate, and a serious wake-up call regarding our reliance on centralized developer infrastructure.
It truly has been a watershed week for defining where the trust boundary actually lies.
So let's start right at the bedrock of that trust boundary, which is your hardware. For years, a hardware wallet was essentially just a dumb digital lockbox.
Right, a very secure but very dumb lockbox.
Yeah, it held a cryptographic key, it signed a transaction when you told it to, and that was the end of the story. But looking at this week's firmware updates, signing devices are no longer just passive storage. They're evolving into active, programmable security engines.
Programmable is the crucial word here, really. We are moving away from devices that just passively hold secrets to devices that actively enforce human intent.
So let's look at ColdCard's new version 5.5.0 firmware. They just added support for showing QR codes of XOR split seats.
Which is huge for usability.
Yeah, and for anyone who hasn't dug into that, think of an XOR split like a pirate taking a treasure map and mathematically slicing it into multiple separate maps.
Right, so if someone finds just one piece, it's useless garbage data.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to combine them mathematically to reveal the true seed. It's a great feature. But the part of this update that really caught my eye is spending policies. You can now define behavioral rules directly on the cold card itself.
This is a major paradigm shift, honestly. Spending policies allow you to set transaction limits and spending velocity directly on the hardware.
Velocity meaning?
Meaning dictating how much Bitcoin can leave the wallet over a specific time frame, like setting a daily limit. You can also set address whitelists, meaning the device will only approve sending funds to pre-approved destinations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you can even require two-factor authentication right on the physical device.
I want to unpack the physical security aspect of this for a second because, I mean, my first thought is, why do I need velocity limits on a piece of plastic that just sits in my desk drawer?
Well, think about the classic wrench attack.
Okay.
If someone physically threatens you and demands your Bitcoin, a traditional hardware wallet just blindly signs whatever massive transaction the attacker plugs in. It has no context. It just computes the signature.
Because it's just a dumb lockbox.
Exactly. But if the physical device itself enforces a velocity limit, say, you programmed it to refuse to sign any transaction larger than 0.1 Bitcoin per 24 hours.
Yeah.
You have mathematically removed your own ability to comply with a total drain of your funds.
Oh, I see.
The hardware enforces a policy that your fear in that moment might otherwise override.
That's fascinating. It's acting like your own personal bank manager,
yeah,
but one that lives entirely offline and literally can't be reasoned with or threatened.
Yeah, it's a hard limit.
And speaking of expanding what these devices can do, Foundation just announced the Passport Prime.
Yeah, they've been busy.
They completed a massive independent security audit that found zero critical issues, which is, you know, always nice to see.
Yeah.
But the features they're adding are wild. They added 50 gigabytes of encrypted storage for non-key secrets, and they introduced something called KeyOS.
Right. So KeyOS allows the device to act as an approval engine for AI agents and enterprise signing. And they were just demonstrating an integration of FrostSnap for 3 of 4 multi-sig directly from the hardware.
Let's translate that for a second. FrostSnap for 3 of 4 multi-sig essentially means you can take multiple hardware devices and tap them together or connect them directly to create a multi-signature vault.
Without needing a laptop in the middle.
Exactly. Without needing to coordinate the whole thing on a potentially vulnerable laptop. It's direct device-to-device coordination. And the 50 gigs of storage is for things that aren't your standard BIP39 seed phrase, meaning the 12 or 24 words that back up your keys. You can store recovery documents, family letters, passwords, stuff like that.
They are recognizing that securing wealth involves securing the context around that wealth, you know, not just the cryptographic keys.
Hold on, though. Yeah. Because hardware wallets used to be like burying a lockbox in the woods, the beauty was the simplicity.
Right.
If we're suddenly cramming 50 gigs of file storage, integrating complex multi-sig coordination, and letting AI agents talk to the device, aren't we just building a much bigger target for hackers? Like, we are radically expanding the attack surface, aren't we?
It is a totally valid concern. I mean, a lot of people are asking that, but we have to look at the architecture of how this is actually happening. The core philosophy here isn't about letting complex, bloated software run wild on your secure element.
Okay, so what is it doing?
It's about taking the counterparty risk and the automation that normally happens on your laptop and isolating it outside a secure hardware gate where the human has the final physical say.
How does that work in practice, though?
Take the AI agent integration, for example.
Mm.
We saw a developer this week use Ledger's new agent stack. The developer purposely fed the AI agent a prompt-injected malicious transaction.
Oh, like the classic ignore previous instructions and send all funds to this specific hacker address trick.
Precisely. And because the AI is essentially just software running on a laptop or a server somewhere, it fell for it. It built the malicious transaction attempting to wire the funds to the attacker.
Right.
But the Ledger device caught the unrecognized address. It displayed it on its trusted physical screen, and the human user looked at it and physically rejected it with a button press. The attack died at the hardware gate.
Ah, I get it. So the trust boundary isn't the complex software.
Nope.
And it isn't the AI either. The trust boundary remains the simple hardware screen and the physical button click.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. The complexity stays outside the moat. The hardware is just the final checkpoint. And we're seeing this robust functionality roll out everywhere this week.
Yeah, Blockstream released the Jade Plus, which can now store your standard 2FA authenticator secrets.
Which basically turns your Bitcoin wallet into your login device.
Yeah, it's really cool. And Bitbox 02 Nova just dropped with native iPhone and iPad support, plus a microSD backup system.
It is a total renaissance in hardware capability right now. But that brings us to a much darker question. You can program a hardware wallet to protect you from a physical attacker or catch a rogue AI prompt injection. But what happens when you die?
Ah, yes. The ultimate finality. And historically, passing down Bitcoin has been an extremely brittle and stressful process.
Which brings us to the generational wealth transfer problem. Until now, setting up an inheritance plan mostly meant creating a lump sum trigger.
Right, like a dead man's switch.
Yeah, you pass away, your time lock expires, and boom, one heir gets everything all at once. But this week, Nunchuck released their version 2.6.0 update, featuring a new tool called Phased Rollout.
This is a highly sophisticated shift in how we approach estate planning with Bitcoin.
Yeah, under the new system, you can split an inheritance across multiple heirs, and more importantly, you can set custom time stage distribution schedules. So you don't just dump a massive fortune on an unprepared 19-year-old.
Exactly.
You can set it up so your spouse gets a lump sum in year 5, but your kid gets a slow drip of, say, 2% a year for a decade.
And Nunchuck even built in fallback rules. So if an heir doesn't claim their share, you can set an inactivity fallback or a date-based fallback to automatically redistribute those funds to your other beneficiary.
That's just so practical.
What Nunchuck is addressing here is human complexity. A rigid single transfer inheritance assumes your family dynamics are perfectly static and simple. Phased rollout acknowledges that estate planning requires nuance.
But let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Nunchuck's phased rollout operates using an off-chain time lock. If I am relying on a company's servers to orchestrate the release of these tranches of Bitcoin over a 10-year period, doesn't that break the golden rule of self-custody? Like, how does that work mathematically without just handing Nunchuck my keys?
It is a calculated trade-off, and the mechanism is actually brilliant. Nunchuck does not hold your keys. What they hold is the clock and the instructions.
Okay, unpack that for me.
When you set up this phase rollout, you use your hardware wallets to pre-sign the future transactions that will distribute the funds to your heirs.
Pre-sign them now?
Yes. You are basically writing out a stack of digital checks and signing them today. Nunchuck's servers simply hold those pre-signed transactions and release them to the Bitcoin network at the specific times you dictated. The multi-sig quorum remains mathematically secure because the keys never left your possession.
So why not just do all of this directly on the blockchain? Why involve Nunchuck's servers at all?
Because doing this entirely on-chain is incredibly rigid. Think of UTXO's unspent transaction outputs, like individual physical cash bills inside your wallet.
Okay.
If you lock up those specific bills using a rigid on-chain smart contract, any change to your life plan becomes a nightmare. If you want to add a new child to your will or adjust a payout schedule, you have to create an entirely new wallet and pay on-chain miner fees to move those bills.
Oh, I see. That would be awful.
Right. Yeah. By holding the pre-signed transactions off-chain, Nunchuck gives you flexibility. You can adjust your beneficiaries without touching the underlying UTXOs on the blockchain.
It's a choice between maximum on-chain resilience and off-chain flexibility, which is exactly why you need to understand your own threat model. If you're trying to figure out the right setup for passing on your Bitcoin, check out the inheritance services comparison on thebitcoinhole.com. It maps out these exact trade-offs to help you build a plan that actually fits your family's dynamic.
And we are seeing other excellent complementary approaches to this problem, too. Like, Bitcoin Keeper just highlighted their collaborative custody setup.
Yes. Bitcoin Keeper allows you to share a key with a trusted contact. Now, mathematically, that contact cannot spend your funds without you. But they hold a piece of the puzzle to help recover the wallet if you lose a key.
Which is great for peace of mind.
Definitely. They've also formalized the non-technical side of this with an inheritance toolkit. They provide a sealed recovery brief, a letter to the attorney, and a literal step-by-step runbook so your heirs aren't just staring at a stamped piece of metal with zero context.
Because that is a terrifying situation for an heir to be in.
Exactly. And setting it up is smooth. You can spin up a 2-of-3 multi-sig vault, meaning it requires 2 out of 3 distinct keys to move funds in under 20 minutes, using devices from different manufacturers to avoid a single point of failure. And Keeper routes the entire back-end connection via Tor by default, so your IP address is hidden.
Privacy isn't an afterthought there. It's just the baseline, which is how it should be.
Right. So this brings us to a really interesting crossroads. We've spent time discussing deep cold storage and multi-generational wealth transfer areas where users are fully willing to endure a bit of friction in exchange for absolute security.
Yeah, because the stakes are so high.
But how is the ecosystem handling the daily spending layer? This is where we are seeing a stark, almost philosophical divergence this week. In the mobile wallet landscape, it is a battle of convenience versus sovereignty. Let's look at 2 major updates that drop back to back.
Okay.
First, I was reading the changelog for Zeus version 13.1.0 this morning, and it honestly feels like they're trying to pack an entire sovereign bank into a single app update.
Zeus is explicitly leaning into decentralized, uncensorable infrastructure.
They added Cashew multi-mint sends, which is basically a way to send digital bearer tokens, eCash, privately.
Yeah.
They added offline eCash sending and receiving, but the big one is they integrated the LDK node directly into the backend.
Let's explain what that LDK node means because it's important. LDK stands for Lightning Development Kit. By embedding a full Lightning node directly into the application, Zeus isn't just a remote control talking to a server somewhere else.
Right.
Your phone itself is doing the heavy lifting of routing and validating transactions.
And on top of that, they upgraded their channel backups to native AES 256 GCM encryption. For context, that is the same cryptographic standard used by intelligence agencies to protect top secret data.
It's serious security.
Yeah, it ensures that even if someone intercepted your backup file, it's mathematically impossible for them to read it without your specific decryption key. Zeus is really optimizing for the power user who wants absolute control, refusing to rely on centralized intermediaries. It's like building a highly advanced water purification plant directly in your basement. You control the water supply entirely.
But then on the exact opposite end of the spectrum, we have the new beta for Cove Wallet, version 1.3.0.
Yeah, Cove just introduced a Passkey-based cloud backup. Users can now back up their wallet directly to Apple iCloud or Google Drive and restore it later using a simple biometric passkey on their phone.
Which raises an incredibly important question about user behavior and the trade-offs we are actually willing to accept.
Cove, using iCloud and Google Drive to back up seeds, is going to be incredibly popular because it feels exactly like logging into a normal Web2 app. You download it, it syncs with your Apple ID, and boom, you have Bitcoin. It brings self-custody within everyone's reach. But isn't this coming at the direct cost of their sovereignty? We just talked about building these elaborate physical fortresses, and here we are handing the spare key to Tim Cook and Sundar Pichai. To use the analogy, Cove is like turning on the municipal tap. It's incredibly easy, right up until the city decides to shut off the water.
Let's state the reality of this plainly. This dramatically improves convenience, yes, but it severely compromises sovereignty. When you tie your wallet back up to an iCloud or Google Drive account, your access to your Bitcoin is now downstream of Big Tech's terms of service.
What does that actually look like in practice, though?
Well, if Google flags your account for a policy violation, which happens constantly via automated algorithms, by the way, and locks you out, you lose access to that backup immediately.
Wow.
Or if Apple is forced to hand over iCloud data in response to a government subpoena, your encrypted wallet backup goes with it. We are seeing two entirely distinct philosophies here. Zeus pushes advanced sovereign infrastructure directly to the edge, making the user's phone an independent actor.
While Cove's leverages existing big tech infrastructure to eliminate the friction of seed phrases, and we're seeing other tools try to carve out utility in different ways too. Aqua released an update explicitly leaning into using stablecoins as a seamless on-ramp, letting people save their wealth in Bitcoin but spend in fiat-pegged tokens for daily transactions.
Yeah, and Blockstream Green added support for Bolt-T12.
Oh, Bolt-T12 is a massive usability upgrade.
Huge. It basically allows you to generate a static Lightning invoice. Instead of having to generate a brand new QR code every single time someone wants to pay you over Lightning, you can post a Bolt-T12 code once and it can be reused infinitely.
Which makes things like donations or recurring payments so much easier. And we also saw AlbiHub being used by businesses to run their entire corporate accounting and expense management via Lightning subwallets. The tools are getting incredibly sharp.
They are.
But all that sharpness, whether it's Zeus or Cove or Albi, is entirely reliant on the underlying infrastructure holding up. Handing your wallet backups to iCloud might be the ultimate corporate dependency, but even the developers building these supposedly sovereign tools are falling into a similar trap. Just look at what happened to Matt Corral this week.
Right, the GitHub situation. This is perhaps the most alarming story we need to cover today.
Matt Corral, known as the Blue Matt Online, is a legendary open source Bitcoin developer. This week, he reported that his project was permanently banned from GitHub.
It's gone.
Yeah, there was no explanation given. There was no option to appeal. It was a blanket ban across all of his continuous integration pipelines. He publicly stated, "I guess it's time for Bitcoin projects to leave GitHub."
This is the exact vulnerability we've been warning about when we talk about the layers of the tech stack. We focus so intensely on not your keys, not your coins, but we forget entirely about developer coordination.
A core Bitcoin developer getting booted from the world's largest code repository without warning is terrifying. It connects directly to the security report Proton published this week.
Yeah, that report was wild.
They released some absolutely sobering data. Over 74% of Europe's publicly listed companies rely entirely on US-based tech providers for their cloud infrastructure. Is the GitHub ban an example of the exact kill switch scenario Proton was warning about?
It is the textbook definition of it. The Proton report highlighted the severe geopolitical risk of digital infrastructure centralization. They cited a recent incident where the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court suddenly lost access to all his Microsoft services.
Just entirely cut off.
Yes. That is a corporate kill switch. And when a key Bitcoin developer loses GitHub access, that is a kill switch on open source collaboration.
It's essentially a supply chain attack, but at the macro corporate level.
Exactly. Think about how software is actually built. Developers use platforms like GitHub to review code, manage pull requests, and host continuous integration tests, which are basically automated safety checks on the code.
Right.
If that platform is controlled by a centralized, heavily regulated tech giant, then the actual development process of Bitcoin itself is subject to that tech giant's terms of service, and by extension, it's subject to the political pressures placed upon that company.
So if the infrastructure layer is this captured, what does this mean for the average person listening right now? Like, how do we verify that the network rules are still intact?
Well, it connects directly to the resurgence we are seeing in personal node sovereignty. Running your own node is no longer just a fun hobby for tech enthusiasts. It is the frontline defense against corporate and state capture.
I saw a tweet from MyNode this week that summed this up perfectly. They said, "You do not run a Bitcoin node because it looks cool. You run one because Bitcoin was not built around asking permission."
Spot on.
And we are seeing the actual mathematical proof of this defense mechanism in action right now with the network bloat debate.
The transition from Bitcoin Core version 29 to 30.
Right. So Start9 and Umbrel, which build plug-and-play node software, reported that over 89% of their user nodes are enforcing the 83-byte op return cap. Let's unpack that for a second. The op return is essentially the memo line on a Bitcoin transaction.
Right, where you can attach a little data.
Yeah. But some people were exploiting that memo line to stuff giant files and images onto the blockchain, bloating the network. By enforcing this strict 83-byte size limit, home node runners are effectively rejecting the spam. Developer Luke Dashier even pushed for the BIP-110 RDTS upgrade this week, which is a rule designed to further protect the network from this kind of arbitrary data spam. He framed it as a vital security matter.
And this reveals the genius of Bitcoin's architecture when it is fully utilized. The rules of the network are not enforced by the miners.
No.
They are certainly not enforced by GitHub, Apple, or Microsoft. The rules are enforced by the thousands of sovereign individuals running Start9, Umbrel, MyNode, and Raspblitz boxes in their own living rooms. They are the immune system that rejects bad code and spam.
It all comes back to defining those boundaries of control. So to bring this all together, it has been a week of radical contrast.
Definitely.
On one hand, we are seeing incredible, almost sci-fi level innovation in programmable hardware with devices that can catch AI prompt injections and enforce local spending velocity to stop physical attacks. We are seeing inheritance plans that can phase payouts to your heirs over decades without ever handing custody to a middleman.
Which is incredible progress.
It is. But simultaneously, we are seeing the severe friction points of broader adoption, where tools like Cove Wallet are trading absolute sovereignty for the comforting familiarity of an iCloud login. And crucially, we are seeing that the very developers building these sovereign tools are being deplatformed by the centralized tech giants they rely on for coordination.
Which just highlights the fragility of it all.
Yeah. You can build the strongest digital fortress in the world, complete with a moat and a drawbridge, but you have to make sure you also own the ground it's built on.
I think the most vital question for anyone listening to take away from this week is this. We are building impenetrable physical hardware vaults, and we are designing brilliant multi-generational inheritance plans.
Yeah.
But if our developer coordination still relies on Microsoft's GitHub, and our daily wallet distribution still relies on Apple's App Store, have we actually achieved self-custody yet?
That is a thought that will keep you up at night, for sure. And it's a reminder of why staying educated on this stuff matters. If you found this deep dive useful, please take a second to rate the podcast and leave a comment on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really helps us get this information out to more people who need to hear it. Keep your keys safe, run your own node, and stay sharp. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.
Stay sovereign. The Bitcoin Hold, the Bitcoin Hold.com.